God, Christ, Gurus. God, Christ, Gurus. God, Christ, Gurus. This is a mega mantra that is most powerful, and in your time of need, it is a protection and a cause for healing, as it has been for thousands, and I'm sure by now tens and tens of thousands. I've experienced it myself, and there are so many who have had the protection, healing, interconnection with God. Even if Lari Mahasaya said that anyone who repeats the name Babaji with deep reverence will have an instant blessing. And so it is also with God, Christ, Gurus, given to us by our great master. I sent out a posting this morning entitled "The Crisis," and it has a quote from Thomas Paine: "My country is the world, and my religion is to do good." Upon waking this morning, thoughts streamed from the superconscious mind that included the phrase, "These are the times that try men's souls," then followed by a stream of thought. There are times in life when great trials come, and other times when life has a happier nature. These two alternating experiences can be graphed like a sine wave or a financial chart of rolling stock as they move up and down, an inevitable movement in life. It was Thomas Paine who wrote these words about trying times entitled "The Crisis." It was toward the beginning of the American Revolution when a small number of militia, farmers and silversmiths untrained in war, took up arms against what, at that time, was the greatest army and navy in the world. And things were not going well. Not only do such crises occur on fields of military action, but in family life, professional life, and very importantly, in our spiritual pursuit. From the first paragraph of Paine's inspired writing, we may borrow its wisdom and strength to meet our own crisis when it comes. Quote, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. When we obtain too cheap, what we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. Is it not true, what we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly?" My thoughts were then guided to Mother Hamilton and the life she lived, enduring one trial and difficulty after another. It was destined that she would chart a course largely on her own, unaided by organization and not often understood by those around her. Yet her determination, the steel of will, under her velvet love for God, Guru, and humanity, never wavered. We can draw so many lessons of loyalty and strength of resolve from Mother's life. Life can challenge us to the core. The goal is high, and what is higher than God realization, then the price must be steep. To paraphrase Krishna in the Gita, fight the good fight with all of your strength, and be ever focused on God. Whether you win or lose, in the outer sense, is not in your control. That is up to me, up to God. But whether you win or lose by staying focused on me, you win the spiritual battle by being aligned with truth and ever advancing in self-realization. Pain goes on. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. When you conquer hell by realizing God, the glory of triumph is not a ticker tape parade or your picture in the paper, but it is the bliss that wells up from deep within. It is the light of your eternal being blazing, and it is the revelations of inspired wisdom from the infinite. Anchor yourself in this thought in the times of crisis and in the times of ease. God and gurus and all saints and spiritual masters who have ever tread this path of realization are with me. Awareness of the fact that I am never standalone means that when I touch the fabric of God's being through remembrance of Him, I touch the glory of all that He is. And reading to you from the Gospel of Swami Ramdas, and making some dietary changes and having some detoxing, and my vision has been fuzzy, so I admit to these classes only as a temporary need while I'm doing this detoxing. And this is dated Anandashram, October 30th, 1957. The two platforms under construction beneath the banyan and peepal trees were being raised. After some consideration, Papa decided they must be made into one long cement platform, and it was done accordingly. When Papa came up that way after visiting the office, he remarked, "You see, we want money in thousands. Money coming in driblets won't do. Ram has now to wake up and send the necessary money. He is sleeping now. That won't do." Isn't that wonderful, the way Papa talks to God? He knows his total reliance is on Him. At one point, someone suggested that they create a foundation and start putting money into it and keeping it as a savings account that can be rolled over from year to year. And Papa said, in response, "Yes, you can do that. And then you can take all of Ram Dass's books, load them up in a truck, and dump them in the ocean." So I guess that was his answer. And every year, the ashram completely empties its coffers and starts over brand new in their new fiscal year, with complete trust that if God wishes for the work to continue, He will provide for it. And if He does not, and it's not fulfilling the will of God, then He won't provide for it. Isn't that a wonderful demonstration? Continuing on, Papa had been reading from various books to the Hamiltons between 2 p.m. and 2:30 p.m. In the afternoon, he started reading from the November issue of The Vision, just received from the press. Krishna Iyer and Ganga were also present. Before reading, Papa remarked, "There's a poem written by John Roebuck in which he says that God has given us the power to see how others see us. We are always looking at us only from our own angle. We must know how others look at us. Ram Dass is going to read out something written by Prasanna, Mrs. Jean Herbert of Geneva, about Ram Dass. Ram Dass did not like very much to read it out of himself, as others might consider him a conceited fellow." So saying, he burst into laughter, in which all joined. Papa read out the long article and a few others from the journal. After he had finished reading, Ralph Hamilton took it from him. On opening it, he found a slip of paper pasted to it, which was printed the following: The readers of the vision are hereby informed that Swami Ramdas' general health continues to be fairly good. He is not observing mona or silence. He is normally active, but his complete rest is considered necessary. He has stopped touring for 3 years and correspondence for the future. Ralph, you say you have stopped touring for 3 years and correspondence for the future? Do you mean to say that you are not going to write letters at all in future? That will be terrible for devotees. Papa, Ramdas has been writing for the past 26 years. The friends and the copies of all these thousands of letters are kept in hundreds of files. He has given in his letters and books, whatever he has to say. He has exhausted himself and he has nothing more to say. The same people are writing over and over again on the same subject. They just do not follow the instructions, but go on asking him more questions. Ramdas feels that they should now, instead of writing letters, have Ramdas in their mind and be in tune with him. When friends come to the ashram, Ramdas will talk to them and they can ask him all the questions they have. Ramdas is tired of writing letters. Mother, what about the new devotees to whom you have not written so far? Papa, let them come here and see Ramdas. Mother, but all cannot afford to. They just don't have the means to come. Papa, that is not correct. If they have intense aspiration, God will help them to come. Mother, as in my case. Yes, Ramdas had some time ago decided not to give lectures or speeches. He felt that people should get spiritual strength and get transformed at his very sight. There were such cases too. Suppose people write to you. Don't you reply to them at all? Are you asking Swami Satchidananda to write on your behalf? Papa, Ramdas asks him to send replies and gives him some hints here and there. He sends the replies all right. Mother, from what you are doing, one may wrongly think that you are going to drop the body. Devotees may be anxious. Papa, people are anxious. They write letters inquiring after Ramdas' health. Are you going to write another book? No, he has already written in his books what he has to say. Mother, then your stopping the work is perhaps to give me the strength to start on my writings. I have been trying to put it into writing, my visions and other experiences, but I have not been able to make a start yet. I felt this morning that I have come here to get the fullest spiritual experience. Papa, you will get it. In pausing there, Swami Satchidananda said that was the only time he had ever known Papa to give a direct confirmation to somebody. Many ask whether they would get their God realization. And the fullest experience meant fullest God realization, Sahaja Samadhi. And to his knowledge, Swamiji's, that was the only time the Papa ever voiced that someone would absolutely get their God realization. Isn't that something? Continuing on with Papa, that is what you have come for. Thousands of miles from your home. You are being prepared for it, and you will get the experience you have been longing for. You can put all your experiences in books for the Western people. You will be a great spiritual force to guide the people in America. God will make you a blazing and powerful instrument to spread His message in America. Mother, may it come to pass by your blessings. Papa, yes, it will. These are powerful words. If this was an ordinary conversation between two individuals, you could take it for granted that perhaps it's just hyperbole or just the thoughts, speculations by two different ones. These are two great spiritual beings. And when Papa made this prophetic statement, it came in such positive and powerful words. Now, when we look at Mother's life, we see that she had such a powerful influence on the group that followed her. One time when I was talking about Mother, somebody asked, "Is she famous?" And I said, "Well, to a small group of people, she's very famous." And this is true. But it wasn't a worldwide kind of impact. But I look at the lives of many saints and realized masters, and so many times, it may be hundreds of years before that one really takes off and fulfills the total purpose for which he or she came. You look at the life of Jesus, and you see that at the end of his life, from a worldly standpoint, you would have to say it was a total failure. He was betrayed by one of his inner circle. All of his close disciples ran away and were hiding in fear. He was taken and abused and scourged and then finally nailed onto a cross, one of the worst ways to be able to die. And all that were around him were a few family and John, we were told. And so it looked like a total bust. And yet you look at his life, and in the beginning it didn't look like perhaps it was going to be too much. The disciples were closely gathered. They were afraid for repercussions, that they too would be victims of Roman justice. And so they were hiding out. But gradually, experiences started to come to them. Jesus came to them. He resurrected himself. And for 40 days, he was with them and taught. I think it's one of the strangest absences in the Bible that it says that he was there for 40 days. And yet, there's not one word recorded about what he did or said during that time, other than when he initially met with the disciples. What did he teach? What did he do? What were their reactions to him? They're totally silent on this. And perhaps the Master asked them not to speak of it. There are so many of the internal teachings. They are given in parable form. And yet, Jesus said to others, "It is given in parable. To you, directly, it is the truth." And so this is the way that it is. When people read the scriptures, the way that they look at it tells you whether they were on the outside or the inner circle. Because the inner circle is getting the direct truth. They're getting the revelations from God. If people are on the outside, they look at the parable form. They look at the outer story. And there are historians who spend their entire life looking at the history that was surrounding the time of Jesus. Did he really live? Did he really exist? There's so little evidence of that. What did he mean? What were the historical context? What were his actual words? We don't have his actual words. Did he speak in Greek? Probably not. And yet much of the scriptures that we have were written in Greek. So we don't even have his direct words in that sense. Translations can never be a direct translation of the exact words. And you don't always know the historical context, so there are many things that we don't know. And yet, look at the power of this one man of God, this one avatar, a pure spiritual being who descended into flesh. And what a powerful impact he has had. But it took hundreds of years. In the beginning, there were just those few, and then there were small groups scattered throughout the Mediterranean. And St. Paul entered into the picture. And after a period of penance that he felt was due, and perhaps he is starting to have real spiritual experiences, then he started to teach. And he expanded it beyond a Jewish movement Before that, it had only been Jews who were involved, and it was a great controversy. Would you involve Gentiles, people who were not of the chosen people? It was not clear at all to the original disciples that it should be so. But because Paul was so insistent, and Peter finally got a revelation that it should spread out beyond only the Jewish people. And so Paul was the great harbinger who went out and talked to all the people. And he also emphasized different aspects of the teachings. I once was taking a history of the early church class at the University of Washington. And there were writings from Peter, and some of them were said to be original, but they didn't make it into the Bible. And I said to the professor, Professor Williams, it seems to me that perhaps Peter lost out to Paul in the end because these letters weren't published as part of the Bible. And yet Paul's were. Now, not all of Paul's letters are thought to be actually Paul's. But nevertheless, he became a tremendous influence. And he spread the word. And initially, the disciples thought Jesus was going to return right away because he said, there be some standing here who shall not die before they see the coming of the kingdom. Now, for those who were thinking that Jesus was going to be coming out of the clouds up in the sky, you see, they didn't see evidence of that. But what Jesus meant is there's some here who have the realization of God before they leave the body. This is the coming, second coming of Christ. This is what is intended, and many didn't try to form any great organizations because they were happy being where they were. They were living in caves. They were out in the desert where there is peace and quiet. One of the things about a cave, when you get into one, is how much insulation against worldly vibration can seem. You're surrounded perhaps by granite rock. And there's a wonderful stillness and a wonderful peace that can be. Now, many caves are very wet and uncomfortable kinds of affairs. I remember going into St. Thomas Cave near Madras in India, and it's the most beautiful cave I've ever seen. It was maybe 40 feet across. It was 10 feet high in the center and sloped off in both directions. Very, very smooth rock. And it was said there that some Brahmin priests came to kill him or do him harm. And there was only one entrance, and they stood at the entrance. And so St. Thomas reached up into the rock and pulled the rock down and created another hole. And you can see there where the rock looks different there. It's glass-like. And you can see splines going up through the rock. It's almost like you can see the fingers that were reaching up into the rock and then pulled the rock down. And he got out and he escaped that by that means. And so it's a very interesting thing. But I thought, this is a wonderful cave. I wouldn't mind staying here at all. Babaji's cave is wonderful spiritually, but it's quite wet. And when you go, if a guide takes you, then they give you a little blue mat so you can sit down there and not get yourself soaked. And the inner portion is sealed off now because a Swami had crawled in there and he had died. And so they sealed it off. But the larger portion of the cave is still there. And when I sat and meditated in that cave, I felt myself easily expand out as if a million miles were nothing at all. This infinite state of consciousness was easily accessible as I sat in this cave. And it was a beautiful experience. So caves are magnificent in that way. And we don't always realize when we're surrounded by people, or when we're surrounded by electronics, cars, vehicles, all the rest of it, how busy, how rajasic the energy is around us. How much is constantly going on beyond our own awareness. We learn to screen things out, and this is a good thing, otherwise we would be overwhelmed by this world and the senses. So we select those things that are important. But there are people who can't exist unless they have music playing or the radio going or the computer going. There has to be constant stimulation. And the brain gets used to it. It gets addicted to it. We are told now that the first 2 years of an infant's life should not have electronic stimulation, that it actually changes the nature of the brain. And this is true later on too, as well. We should be teaching our children how to take time out in silence. I spent a lot of time in silence when I was young. I would play by myself using my imagination. And it was a good thing, because imagination is a powerful thing for the mind. And to learn how to tune into it opens up new worlds. And it has a way of sometimes opening up the spiritual world. Some people can think that spiritual experiences are imagination. But when you know imagination, you know the difference between that and God. Many people have rich, wonderful imaginations, and it can be used for a very powerful and good thing. But it is nothing in comparison to an inner spiritual experience. Now, how do you tell the difference? It is powerful when a spiritual experience comes to you. It's not just a thought or a feeling. It lifts you up. It transforms you in some way. And you get information that otherwise would not be available. So this is a wonderful thing to be able to distinguish these two, and it's important because there are some people that whatever idea just floats to their head, well, that's God telling me. But that's not doing the work. That's laziness. To really tune into God requires a great deal of effort. We have to learn how to quiet the mind, to still the mind, to become that perfect witness inside. Until we are a receptive, I want to say blank, but that's not quite the right word, but we want to be a blank slate that God can write upon, that His thoughts can impress Himself on. We don't want to create a blank mind. That happens spontaneously through our Kriya Yoga. That's the after effect that we're looking for. I've heard people talk about, I do this many Kriya or that many Kriya, or I do this Kriya or that Kriya, as a badge of honor, but it's all foolishness if it doesn't lead to a still state of mind. Chanting Ram Nam will do the same thing. And the vibration of that Ram Nam will eventually take us into that stillness. Now, Mother taught us both, along with Hong So. So we have these powerful methods for being able to achieve God realization. But as Papa talked about here, people will write him again and again asking the same questions. Now, it's true, there are themes that seem to follow us. And just asking the same question doesn't always indicate that we haven't made any advancement. But so oftentimes, we're not applying what we have already been given. Not with everything that we have inside. With all of our heart, with all of our mind, with all of our strength. Apply yourself to these techniques. If you're not getting the results, don't blame the tools. The tools are there. And they have transformed lives into being fully realized masters. So there's nothing wrong with the tools. It's a matter of really getting to work and putting yourself fully into it. It's so easy, especially in the beginning. We may feel a honeymoon phase, and we're so enthusiastic. We're so filled with God consciousness. And it's a wonderful, wonderful time. It is like a honeymoon that can happen between a newly married couple. And then life begins. And you have to go through your day-to-day events, and you have to work, and you have to perhaps raise family, and all the other things that we get involved with. And gradually, the edge off of our sadhana begins to get a little blunt. We're not applying ourselves. And in the beginning, it's an interesting thing. Momentum works both ways. The momentum of ignorance keeps you in ignorance even when you are intensely practicing sadhana. And we wonder, why is it not coming? You know, we want to take our pulse every 10 minutes and see whether there's a change or not. But gradually the changes do happen. Gradually we are lifted up. And that takes on a certain momentum as well. And so we can slack off. We can divert our mind. And I have been guilty of this. I have seen a time when I diverted my mind some. And I checked in, and I had the same feeling of God that I had before. I didn't realize that I was putting myself onto a downward trajectory, that I had deviated off of the path. And as a result of that, it's just like mathematics. You can chart it out with geometry. You're going to start to go downhill. You're going to start to lose things. And then ignorance comes in and it clouds your judgment. And you make even more wrong-headed decisions. And down and down and down you go. And finally, you end up at the very bottom of a hole. And you may even wonder yourself, how did I get here? I thought I was doing all right. God, why did you abandon me? And God didn't abandon you. You abandoned him. And he, being a respecter of free will, allowed you to do so. But we learn our lessons that way. And hopefully we learn them quick, not over many, many lifetimes. And we get right back onto the spiritual journey. We realize that every thought is a creation. Every thought is a creation. And when you think about your thoughts, you realize sometimes how out of control our minds are. And we may feel helpless against that. And yet, we are responsible. It is our job to focus our minds, to put ourselves at the feet of God, to practice these things that we have been given. That is our job. Now, when we invoke God and Guru's grace, it comes to us. And so it's a help, it's a support. And yet there is a responsibility on our part to be able to really put ourselves firmly on the path and do the things that we've been taught to do. Now, they're not complicated things. They're simple things, but they're powerful. And what you realize over time, there's power in simplicity. You take the idea of loving your neighbor as yourself. Take that one simple principle. Now, your neighbor, who is your neighbor? And Jesus pointed out that it's whoever is next to you. It's not because he's part of your tribe or your religion or your family. Not at all. All are your neighbor. And how you treat them, how you regard them, is vastly important. And so you take one simple principle like that and you go to work on yourself. And you say, all right, some people are easy to love, and mostly people who love me and I like I find it easy to be with them. But somebody who's difficult personality, that's much harder. We go to work on ourselves. We shoot love at the person who is a difficult person. We see them filled with light, filled with God. I remember there was a lady at work. She put in computer input. And she was in the old days, we'd call a crusty old broad. And for my parents, grandparents' generation, they might say, you get strung up today if you say something like that. But I say it most affectionately because I grew up with women like that. Kind of tough on the outside, but soft as a marshmallow on the inside. And I just made up my mind, I'm going to somehow break through that crustiness on the outside. And it took me months coming in, and it wasn't an all-out assault. I'd try this thing and that thing. And finally one day I told her a joke that just made her crack up. And after that I was her best friend. And so we look at people who are difficult. We think of God being in their hearts. We think that divine presence is there. Perhaps it's sleeping. How can I awaken it? And we challenge ourselves. We challenge ourselves because our initial reaction is to put them away, to put the label on them, to put them into a box and say, you are this. And what a terrible thing we do to that individual when we do not see God inside of them. This is the thing that we must learn. I'd like to read a bit from the New Journal. It's a wonderful journal if you haven't read it. I know people who set it aside and wait for a time when they can really absorb it and perhaps just read one thing each evening. And so this is Mother from the Inner Kingdom. The inner kingdom that we have is such a tremendously marvelous, mystical thing of God's creation that it is difficult for us to comprehend in worldly consciousness with our worldly mind. And yet, we have the kingdom of heaven within us and the kingdom of earth. It is up to us whether we want to live in this kingdom of heaven or solely in the kingdom of earth. We can make sure this earth is a heaven, or we can make it a hell, and that too is within us, and the choice is ours. This body is so wonderful when you stop to think about it. It is an exact replica of everything in the outer universe. We have the sun, which is the spiritual eye in the center of the forehead. We have the moon, which is the second brain, the solar plexus. We get feelings of intuition there, which, when we are tuned in with the Spirit, gives us information which is absolutely true. We have the rivers, which are the circulatory system. We have an elimination system. We have a system which breathes and provides oxygen, which keeps life in our body. Above all, we have a heart, and all of which is within us, and tied in this one place within us, which is the seat of all life. When you are about to put your feet on the spiritual ladder, we go through many stages. In the beginning, perhaps, we don't even believe in God. We don't believe in a superior power, a superior intelligence. But gradually, through the experiences of life, many of which are very difficult, we are forced to turn our attention, our faces, toward a higher power, to acknowledge there is such a thing, to reach out, perhaps crying in our need, Father, help me. In this stage, Mother could have been talking about me when I first got on the path. Even the most hardened criminal, when he is faced with something terrible, perhaps as a result of the sins that he has committed, finally reaches out to God and says, God, help me. God, save me. And then the soul awakens to the fact that there is a superior power. We go through the various stages of belief in the Orthodox teachings, of which there are many and varied. But at last there is a reaching out from the darkness for something that is greater, and it is an urge to know the mystery of life, to know about the riddle of life. The inner urge is this exactly: man, know thyself. Do you really know yourself, the real self? Or are you acquainted with just this outer person, the one who has been taught reading, writing, arithmetic, the various arts and sciences, and the superficial things of life? Or do you know your real self, which is God within you? You put your feet upon this path, and you start your upward journey. You don't know where it's going to take you, so you lay hold of a great thing, and that is called faith. Faith in God, faith in His power to provide all that is necessary for you, to protect you through all the experiences which you, as an individual, are going to go through. We are all on this path, but for one purpose, and that is to realize our oneness with our Father. It is said that the kingdom of God and the kingdom of heaven are both within. If we find God first, then all these other things are added unto us. This is true. Whatever clothes we need, whatever food we need, whatever money we need, whatever we need in service is given unto us when we give ourselves completely and absolutely to God. Now, to many people, this is a fearful thing to do because you do not have jurisdiction over yourself. You're very independent. And you think of yourself, but I know what is best for me. Why do I have to surrender myself to God? And yet, do you really? Is everything in your life as you think it should be? Is it all peace and harmony, a thing of beauty, of success, of fulfillment, of complete supply? Or are you still reaching out like a beggar and trying to do everything yourself and most of the time failing very miserably? When you can relax and let yourself be lifted up in the arms of God, when no matter what He requires of you, even your personal life, which is to say your idea of separation from Him, that you are willing to give it with everything you have, then He comes. Then He lifts you up. He puts you through what is necessary, and He takes you unto Himself. And when you say, Father, how is it you ask so little of me when you have given me so much? And this is the absolute truth what Mother teaches here. I know it because I have experienced it in my own life. It would be one thing if these teachings were only for a few, if there were only an inner circle. But that inner circle that Jesus had around Him and that other masters have had can expand and encircle this whole world and contain all humanity in it. Mother had that lovely little poem that she used to repeat, that they drew a circle and drew me out. Infidel, heretic, a thing to flout. But God and I had the wit to win, and we drew a circle and drew them in. Why not take all humanity in? Why not love your neighbor? So take a principle, take something that you want to live up to, and then go to work on yourself and see that you do it. Don't make excuses for yourself. Don't say, if it were not only for this person or that person. I remember somebody was telling me one time about a boss that they had, and he had some horrific things that he did. And still they felt they had to work at this particular place. And I said, think of this individual. You have to live with him for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. He has to live with himself for 24 hours, 7 days a week. We cannot escape ourselves. And when you meet somebody with an unlovely personality or characteristics, Think about the inner person, that innocent person, that divine soul that is in, surrounded and caged by these awful feelings this person has had. Maybe it's raging anger. Maybe it is loathing and self-dislike. And think about what it must be like to be imprisoned like that all the time. Now, that's not excuse making for bad behavior, but it does give you a perspective of compassion for each and every person. I was one time thinking about Adolf Hitler, and I thought, he's going to have to face all the misery, all the pain, all the evil that he perpetrated, not just him personally, but that he set into motion and had others do as a result of what he wanted. And I thought, what a terrible thing he's going to have to go through. How many lifetimes? He's going to have to be such a tremendous saint that he's going to have to change an entire world for the good in order to balance that karma. And so it will have to be. And one day, perhaps, without people knowing the previous life that he had, will sing his laurels because he has to be such a tremendous soul to balance those scales. So you see, it's difficult to judge an individual, even someone who we think so highly of today. We don't know all the times their past and what they are capable of. But we are all capable of redeeming ourselves. Not because we can be perfect. Jesus said one time, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Now, how in the world could we ever live up to that? And how could the Master ever ask us to live up to that? And yet, there is truth, of course, in what he said. Because when we touch the fabric of God, we touch the perfection of God, and we are perfected. Now, it doesn't always happen in a moment. Sometimes, and usually, it is a process. But by constantly reaching out for God and touching the fabric of his being, feeling his peace, feeling his bliss, getting revelations from him of his perfect wisdom, we are gradually purified of everything that is of the dross of this material world of ignorance. And we are perfected. So you see, it is possible. But you don't go around thinking to yourself, "Well, I'm so perfect now." That's the ego's notion of perfection. The reality is that the closer we grow to God, the more humble we become. One is, ego can't enter into that, so it excludes itself from those regions. But the other reason is because as we go closer to God, we become more and more aware of how tremendous this thing that we call God really is. How perfect, how pure, and it brings us to our knees. It makes us bow down before his feet, not out of some slavish preoccupation. We're simply slayed in spirit at the beauty and perfection and the love and the light of God. It's a wonderful thing, a wonderful thing. And how can ego survive that? Now, initially it can, because it resurrects itself in the revelations. It talks about the dragon that comes up out of the sea and tries to put the crown back on the ego again. It's like those movies where the bad person is killed, and you think, all right, all peace and happiness now. And suddenly they rise up out of the grave or whatever they are, and they scare the bejesus out of you. And not only once, but they'll do it several times. And you think, will this person ever die? And it is that way with the ego. And you think, I think I've got a handle on this. And suddenly something comes up out of the depths, rises up out of the ocean, and tries to reassert itself again. So the best thing is to have that constant vigilance. God first. God first, ever first. And not ever lose sight of that. Not ever lose your inner intensity for your spiritual practice, which is keeping your mind on God. Sometimes when people face crisis, it's when they turn to God most easily. Other people, when times are good, it's easy to give God. And sometimes it's just the opposite of whatever time we put our mind. Some people get into a crisis and they immediately think of God. But when times are good, they forget God and put Him in the background until the next crisis comes. Others, when times are good, they think of God. And when the crunch comes, they completely forget God, thinking they've been abandoned by Him. So each one of our tests is peculiar to each one of us. But the method and the modus is the same. And that is to keep our mind on God, to love God more than this world, more than anything else, to strive for Him, to serve Him, to see Him in all beings, to chant His name, to go deeper with Kriya Yoga meditation. We've been given such tremendous tools. Such tremendous tools. So, whether you're in crisis or in times of that life is much easier, let it make no difference to you. Surrender yourself to God and leave the outcome to Him. You know, the more we get focused on a particular outcome, now it doesn't mean that we don't strive for perfection. But we shouldn't get so bound up in the outcome that we lose sight of what we're doing right here in the moment. Take each step. Take each step as God directs you to. And be fully focused on that, knowing that each step is taking you toward the light, toward perfection, toward purity. So with that in mind, always chant behind in the background, God, Christ, Gurus. Think of Master. Bring Him to mind and heart. And you will feel such an instant blessing. Think of Mother. Think of Sri Yukteswarji, Lari Mahashay, Babaji. Think of them. They're all in your corner. You know, I had a method that when I was faced with a decision or I felt something that I thought might be a temptation coming to me, I would put all the masters around me and I would present it to them. And instantly, one of them would give me some reaction that I knew it was either the right thing, there was a smile and a nod of acknowledgement, or it was a definite no. Don't go that direction. So oftentimes when we take the downhill path, we know someplace inside of us it's not the right decision. And yet we do it anyway. And that's because we don't take into consideration what the cost is going to be. One time I started thinking, what if everything that I thought, said, and did was broadcast on the headlines of the newspapers? Would I be happy with what I'm thinking, saying, doing? There is nothing hid that shall not be shouted from the rooftops. So do not think that you have a secret life. Not from God. And it's not that you have to broadcast it to everybody and everything. But with God, there are no secrets. So don't ever catch yourself thinking that you can do something in secret where nobody can see. All my love and blessings, God, Christ, Gurus, God, Christ, Gurus, God, Christ, Gurus. I bow to the great light within you.